time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Now, today I'm speaking with New Zealand media music consultant and owner of Riddler Consulting, David Riddler. David has been a big part of the media landscape in New Zealand, including working in the music funding and promotions division of the New Zealand government's media content funding agency, New Zealand On Air, as head of music. Obviously, you're not doing that now, David, but we'll go into that a bit further. He has an extensive resume that doesn't stop there. He's also been an integral part of the commercial radio space, holding roles in management and talent coaching for notable New Zealand radio brands, including Radio Hauraki, Channel Z, The Hits, and More FM. So welcome to the show, David.
Kia ora, Jamie. I'm literally blushing when I hear all that read back to me. lovely to be here.
It's quite a hit list, to be fair. I don't think I'm going to be speaking to many people in this podcast that will have such a wide variety of, I guess, not only roles, but also experience, because you've worked and been in so many different areas of not only the radio space, but the media space in general, which is insane.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm in my 50s now, Jamie, and you get a bit more reflective as you age gracefully, and I've actually had, it's interesting timing to have a chat to you because I've been feeling more and more grateful and quite overwhelmed with how fortunate a career path I've had and how many different things I've been able to do. And it is when you look at your dust off the CV or have a look through your past and go, oh wow, not sure if it was quite the plan. I don't really think I ever had a plan. It just all sort of fell into place over the years, so sometimes it doesn't make sense at the time, but in retrospect you kind of go, oh okay, it's all paths lead to wherever you are now and whatever might be in the future, right?
And I feel like this is going to be a running theme with everyone I talk to, because I feel no one really goes out intending to get into media or entertainment. I feel like it's kind of something that a lot of people fall into. And speaking of the past, which you mentioned, you grew up in Palmerston North, you attended Palmy Boys, where funnily enough, I did a little bit of like searching around and saw that you were along some pretty famous alumni. And I don't know if you ever got to interact with a lot of these guys. And I'm assuming you've been asked this before. You have, like, obviously Clark Gayford, Jeremy Corbett, Hamish Mackay. Were any of these guys who, well, obviously now are very well known in the New Zealand media and entertainment industry, did you ever like knock shoulders with them? Were they someone that you kind of passed in the hallways? Did they have any influence in you jumping into media, or was this something that kind of happened later in your life?
Nobody's ever asked me that. So thank you, Jamie. Good start. So Palmy Boys, no, I don't think there was anybody there who influenced me in the media direction. I think probably music was the passion that I discovered when I was at Palmy Boys, and I was I sort of felt like I wasn't quite the archetypal Palmy Boys student. So I didn't play rugby because I've had glasses since I was 10 years old. I wasn't really an alpha male, never have been. And, you know, I kind of started rebelling against all of the socks up, short haircuts, marching in the summer mornings kind of regime. I got a bit sick of all that by sixth form. But what I will say is that probably my dad's obsession with 2XS, which was the radio station in Palmerston North that launched in I think in the early 80s as one of the first private radio stations. So there was a big station there called 2ZA, which we used to listen to all the time. And then dad started listening to this 2XS. And I remember I was probably 8 or 9 years old, so before high school, and dad was listening to this radio station and I was annoyed because he wasn't, you know, he kept changing it over this 2XS. And then I guess as I got into my intermediate years and definitely at high school, I became quite obsessed with 2XS and people like Darren Sarank on the night show. I remember ringing up for a request on the top nine at nine or whatever, and he obviously recorded my call and played it back. So I think that's the first time I heard myself on the radio, which was weird. And Robert Scott, I remember from those days. Dominic Harvey, I was actually, Dominic Harvey would be the one person who I was at school with that we used to wag school together, actually, in sixth form. And then I think at the end of sixth form, he left and became the overnight announcer at 2XS. And that went on to lead to him becoming Baldrick with Mike West on The Breakfast Show. And then his career just shot from, you know, shot up from there. But yeah, it was more about 2XS playing. In those days, New Zealand local radio stations had their own playlists and their own program directors. So I think 2XS, it was a pop top 40 station, but it definitely played some stuff that wasn't, you know, I've sort of reflected since on some of my favorite songs from that era, and they definitely aren't big, big, big hits. I think they went a little bit outside the edges, which I always appreciated. And I do know that they had this awesome syndicated show on Sunday afternoons, I think it was, called Rock Over London, which is where I first heard bands like Pet Shop Boys and stuff. They were just introducing lots of new UK music, and I was quite obsessed with that show. But you know, I was a bit of a radio geek actually, in hindsight, because I used to like draw the 2XS logo on my pencil case, and you know, used to just be obsessed with radio, but listening to it anyway. But I never considered working in it when I was at high school.
Because I think that's where the interesting transition comes in, because you went to then move into studying at university, very natural thing for any kind of Kiwi lad coming out of high school. You went to Victoria University, where you studied English Lit and Film, and then you ended up working and kind of volunteering at Radioactive, which at the time I think had just transitioned out from being a student radio station originally to then going private, if I'm not mistaken. So
I was there when that transition happened. It was quite dramatic. But anyway, I'll tell you how it happened. So 1993, my mum and her husband, my stepfather, moved over to the UK for a year to do a teacher exchange, which is where you literally swap jobs, house, car, everything. You swap lives with a UK teacher. And I went over for 6 months. And obviously this is back, so 93 is a long time ago, back when a piece of music would be released physically in the UK and it wouldn't be available in the NZ, depending on the label deal, wouldn't be available in New Zealand sometimes 3-6 months later, a bit like movies and stuff like that. We had to wait for ages for it to get to New Zealand. And this was also the era where toll calls were massively expensive and there was quite a huge delay on the line when you called. So, so contact with my friends in Wellington, a lot of them were from Palmy Boys, actually. I've kept a lot of friends right through from, we've got a really tight-knit group of friends. Anyway, so I would try and write them letters, but I got so bored of writing letters because your handwriting can't keep up with your thoughts. So I thought, maybe I'll just record a tape and just talk and send them a tape, because then I don't have to, can't be bothered. And then obviously I was buying some new music from different record stores. I was based in Leeds, not in London, so that was a bit different too. So I'd be buying music and stuff, and so I thought, I'm pretty stoked on this new Suede single or this new, you know, Smashing Pumpkins or whatever. So I will, I'll drop that song in, and then I'll talk again. And that's how my radio career started, was being too lazy to write long letters to my friends, so talking to them on tape instead. And then I'd send the tape over email to New Zealand. And then they'd sit around and have some beers and make a tape, 90-minute tape of them talking shit. And then they would send that back over to me. So it's quite quaint. But that's how that I. Yeah.
But very forethought. Was this something that you kind of look back on now? Do you still have copies of those tapes? Have they still existed? Have you managed to digitize them?
I actually do. I'm too scared to listen to them, but I do have some of them out in the garage. On reflection, it's quite crazy, because that's when I got back to Wellington early 2000, January 94, I had a whole lot of music that wasn't yet released in New Zealand, like just mostly CDs and stuff. And B, a couple of friends went, those were so good. You should volunteer for Radioactive. And I'm usually quite, well, I used to think I was quite a timid person, or, you know, didn't back myself a lot. But for some reason, I just went, yep, I'm going to do that. So I rocked up to Radioactive, and you have to fill out a form with an example playlist of what you might play on your show. And that was quite overwhelming because, you know, Radioactive was super cool and I didn't feel super cool. But I got to do my first Death Till Dawn, as they call it there, which was like midnight or 1 a.m. till 7 a.m. And I remember playing an Underworld track off Dubno Bass with my headman, which was about 11 minutes long because I was shitting
Great
myself.
Choice.
So I wanted to make sure I had plenty of time to calm my nerves. So I think I did 3 mid-dawns, and then they put me into a morning show. And then over the 2 years there, I ended up on a breakfast show with a couple of other guys, and we kind of wrote, it was active and never had a regular breakfast show. And the three of us kind of shared 4 days a week, but you couldn't do Wednesdays because that was Moo from pre-Fat Freddy's. Chris Fomu, Moo was doing Wednesday mornings, and you couldn't Moo from Wednesday mornings. So we did Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. So, and then I finished my BA and kind of applied for one job and didn't get even an interview. And then at the same time, I'd been pouring so much time and energy into Active, and I kind of went down to the careers office and opened up a folder, and there was the New Zealand Broadcasting School in Christchurch. And I went, oh, actually, that's interesting. So, yeah, next thing you know, I'm living in Christchurch and going to broadcasting school.
And Christchurch at that time would have been quite interesting because you're coming off the back of like some pretty crazy stuff musically as well. But you're talking about the fact that the music that you were listening to was quite life-changing over in the UK. You're listening to stuff that maybe hadn't been listened to before, but then you're moving to Christchurch, which in itself was also well-known for like the Flying Nun scene and all that sort of stuff. So did you kind of almost insert yourself in the alternative music scene in a way by chance, almost by obviously working with these guys at Radioactive, then going to Christchurch for the broadcasting school? Is that kind of what saw you kind of pushed into music radio or not really?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, broadcasting school, we definitely were focused on music radio, and I became, in my second year, so you could take two sort of specialist streams, and mine was voice and programming. And I got very obsessed with programming very quickly because it was, you know, I used to make loads of compilation tapes myself and still have heaps of them lying around and all the rest of it. So I was definitely a music compiler. So programming really interested me. Voice was okay, but I do remember one of my tutors, Maurice Shanahan, we did an ear check, which I'd never done before. Nobody had ever sat there in a room and played my voice back to me and given me feedback. And I remember, I'll never forget what he said. He's like, David, because he's American or something, and I'm going to do a terrible accent. You sound like you're sitting there having a cup of tea and a joint. And I was like, what does that mean? And he's like, if you want a career in radio broadcasting, you need to put some more color and life into your voice. And I was like, oh, okay. So that was great feedback. But that was probably just, you know, I do have quite a flat voice, so I have to put a lot of effort in to make it colorful for on air. And I did end up doing a lot of on air stuff over the years, but it was never really my main focus. Programming was my thing. But in terms of the music in Christchurch, I don't recall. I mean, I went to a few shows at the Town Hall. I went to Tool there. I went to Smashing Pumpkins there, and saw a few bits and pieces. Went to a few clubs. There was a very cool club called Liquor Lounge. I remember going there a few times. But to be honest, most of the memories I have of music there was listening to radio still. And when I went back to Wellington for holiday breaks, Channel Z Wellington had just started, and I remember on a holiday break listening to that, and I heard 3 songs in a row. You know how you have that little cluster of songs that you can kind of judge a radio station on as a program?
Definitely,
you think,
yeah.
It's usually about a 3-song cluster, and I think I heard Joy Division. It was definitely a Joy Division song, and then something else, something Head Like a Hole and something else, and I went, oh my god, this radio station was made for me. Oh my god, this is amazing. So I got quite obsessed with Channel Z, but back then you couldn't really listen online. In fact, it wasn't really online. It was kind of pre-mainstream internet. So that was only then. I listened to a bit of RDU. listen, still bought lots of music, went to there's a couple of great record stores in Christchurch, but most of the gigs I went to were pretty mainstream, to be honest. And I think that was by virtue of the fact that most of my peers at broadcasting school, there were a couple of people who were real music geeks, but most of them weren't as fanatical about indie music. I do remember we pitched when we had in our second year, we had to pitch a radio station that we might set up and run. And I was very passionate, probably through university years, I went to a lot of orientation gigs and got really into New Zealand music. So we pitched an all New Zealand music station as our option. That didn't win. What did win was an 80s music station called The Planet, and I became the program director of The Planet, which was huge fun because I'm an 80s music nut. So I got to program that, which was pretty awesome.
Do you feel like going back to almost the tapes that you're making, it was almost natural that you were going to gravitate to that eventually? When you got given that decision between voice and programming, what was it that screamed out to you when you were like, I know programming's my thing, I know that's where I'm going to be best? What was it? Was there any like particular point to it that you were like, this is the reason why I know I need to get into this?
Maybe Maury's comment about my voice might have had something to do with it. I didn't mind announcing, but I didn't love it. But I did love being in Selector and looking at how an hour of music played out and deciding what tracks would be in different rotates and how it would all work together. And then the ultimate joy for me was listening. So in the weekend or after B school had finished for the day and just driving around and listening, because it was broadcasting and hearing the imaging that we'd put together. So we took cuts of all these different 80s movies and TV shows, and those were nice. Kind of our imaging and stuff. And I mean, it was only 97, so it wasn't like the 80s were that lot previous, but when you've got a cool little snippet from Back to the Future and then you roll into some Mel and Kim or some New Order or something, it just sounded super cool. I thought it sounded super cool. My favorite moment, one of my most memorable moments in realizing that it is being broadcast, is that we went through a KFC drive-through, a couple of friends and I, and they were listening to The Planet in their kitchen at the KFC. You could hear it blasting through their open window. And, you know, you just get that sense that, wow, that influence. Yeah. And I do think at that point there were definitely people at broadcasting school who wanted to be stars and wanted to be up front. And I think I definitely over that year realized that I didn't want to be a public figure. I wanted to be behind the scenes.
It's almost like being the person that selects the songs at a party. Did you feel like it's kind of like you like the idea of setting the identity and setting the whole mood for that particular hour? Because I feel like that's where the programming really does get its power from. And we're probably going to talk about it a little bit later because... we'll segue to it later, but that was particularly how I felt when you did the rebrand of Hodoki. And I remember the first day after the rebrand, and I remember that same sort of mentality that you said of, I need to listen to the first three songs they put on before I make a decision whether this rebrand was good. And obviously, it was fantastic, but I'll talk about that later. But as you said, Channel Z, you were going up to Wellington in between your holiday breaks. You were listening to the station that you thought was incredible. For anyone who's obviously outside of New Zealand, Channel Z was a bit of an outlier, I guess, in terms of radio, because they were doing a lot more alternative music, probably not stuff that many people would hear, but still kind of trying to punch above maybe the pop culture radio stations that were existing at the time. You guys had fantastic talent as well, some really talented broadcasters that went through there. So you are obviously at the time 28, I believe. Is that true?
I was a bit younger, so I think how it played out was, so I finished broadcasting school at the end of 97, and then you go into an internship program, and you're faced up with possibly being posted anywhere in the freaking country. So I could have been in Timaru, for God's sake. But all my friends, really tight group of friends in Wellington, and I applied for a internship with More FM Kapiti, which is one of the sort of satellites of More FM Wellington. And I was really fortunate that I got that internship. So I moved back to Wellington mid-December 97. And More FM Kapiti was basically, studio was housed within, there were two floors for More FM and Channel Z. So it wasn't even called, it was just the More FM group. It wasn't even bought by, it was a locally owned by Doug Gold. Yeah. So one floor was More FM, the More FM empire machine, because that was like a license to print money back then, those More FM stations. And the next level down in the building was More FM Kapiti, the creative department where they wrote all the ads, and Channel Z. So I was hanging out. I mean, what a dream. Yes, I was working More FM Kapiti and I was voice tracking about 10 hours a day of audio and it was ridiculous. And I was basically, I did a bit of ad writing, did lots of promo, worked 6-7 days a week, loved it. And, you know, I definitely got my work ethic really, I think that's when I realized my work ethic and my kind of mindset is just be the solution, you know, just be the person who can always just calmly go. And that sort of solidified through my career, really. But I think that was probably early on where I just went, this is like, I have a whole two, three radio stations at my disposal and studios and all these people who do this for a job. It's so stimulating. Why would I not want to be here the whole time? But yeah, I got to hang out with some of the Channel Z people. So even though my job was not anything to do with Channel Z, I definitely got a taste of that environment and got invited along to a couple of the concerts that they were promoting and got to just see that station in action. And I still get shivers thinking about how exciting that was for a young. I think I'm not sure how old I was then, maybe 25. And then I think I did the More FM job for about a year and a half. I ended up doing some breakfast phones, producing for More FM Wellington, ended up doing mid-dawns that got broadcast across More FM Wellington and Kapiti. For our listeners in Kapiti, I think they had to listen to me from 10 a.m. till 6 a.m. sometimes, which is pretty crazy. As I mean, 10 a.m. one morning till 6 a.m. the next. Yes, it was pretty ridiculous. Or maybe it was, no, sorry, it was drive, 4 o'clock onwards. But then,
I know how you feel.
Then the, yeah.
I did the
yeah,
same thing. I did it in Wanaka, Radio Wanaka. I did the weekends, also did the drive show and a lot of tracking, which was always awkward when I was in the supermarket and they had it playing over in the New World speakers. I could hear myself obviously talking when I was in the meat section. Bit odd.
Yeah. It's very strange. One. It's very strange, but that's resourcing limitations for you back in those days. Look, I got a really great grounding and just a wide range of stuff from client-facing meetings to, like I said, promo, creative writing. You know, when I got to write ads and then they got broadcast on Channel Z and More FM and stuff, and I'm just like, ad voicing as well, all that sort of stuff. So I got a full 360, I reckon. The only thing I didn't do was sell, but apart from that, or load ads into the traffic system. But apart from that, I did just pretty much everything else. And then, yeah, some changes at Channel Z, I think. I was trying to figure this out before I spoke to you. I think it was the end of 99, or maybe the end of 99. There were some changes, and I got shoulder tapped to become the ops manager and day announcer for Channel Z Wellington. So, I mean, within, what, 2-3 years of leaving, 2 years, I think, of leaving broadcasting school, I was working for the station that I had just totally fallen in love with. So that was an early win.
Yeah, of course. And the thing I wanted to rewind a little bit as well, because a lot of people, when they're coming into that internship period or moving away from broadcasting school, the majority of people that obviously go to the school, much like you said, there will be people that want to be personalities or people that want to go for the big hotshot goals or roles in like Auckland, for example. Do you feel like sometimes people look at these roles that look super sexy, but then forget about the fact that what local radio does offer is the fact that you can actually train yourself in a lot of different areas? And secondly, you basically get full creative freedom. Like you said, you were doing ad copy, you're able to speak to a pretty wide audience, you're able to be out in the community. Do you feel like maybe that's something that's a missed opportunity occasionally for people when they just go straight for the big role and don't actually get the opportunity to kind of cut their teeth in local?
It's a really good point. And I think that that's a really good, yeah, it's a really good observation. Obviously, you know, and I'm trying to be better at this now, but I probably didn't take as, wasn't as grateful or as cognizant of that fact at the time. But I look back on my internship and even my first year of working full time on some pittance, and think I couldn't have asked for a better training. And, you know, yes, I mean, I wasn't really in a regional or a provincial market. I was, even though the station I was working for was regarded as provincial, the studio was in Wellington. I was part of a Wellington operation. So I kind of had the best of both worlds. But yeah, I think you can go to broadcasting school and do all the stuff practicing. But when you actually get into an operation and you have the opportunity to do a wide range of things in a smaller operation, I can't think of a better way to just to ground you and to give you a real understanding and empathy for how every other part of the operation works. And I think that's something that I've taken into my career, is I'm a real empathy-based, EQ-based manager, I suppose, or worker. And I think that was something I really did appreciate about that internship period, was that I kind of got to understand what it was like to be in creative and have to ring clients and do the script read and then get the client to come back with this ridiculous feedback, or trying to talk clients out of voicing their own ads yet again. You know, I got to understand what it was like for the production engineer. I got to understand what, you know, and so I think that was a real, in hindsight, that became a real strength, is that I had that deep understanding of what everybody's role was and what particular challenges they faced in that role.
Because then when you moved to Channel Z, like you said, you did some voice work there as well, we're on here, and then you moved into ops, and then eventually the program director, which I feel like, as you said, empathy is definitely a big thing there. So having all those skills previously, do you feel like that made you quite a good leader working for the team, because you had all these pre-existing skills from obviously working in company, as well as also maybe having that passion and love from working with the station that you ideally wanted to be in? Do you feel like both of those kind of elements really helped you balance yourself out as a manager, for not only having love for the station itself, but also acknowledging like, this is going to be a tough time, but we get through it together kind of thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I've never really reconciled my Channel Z program director experience, because in hindsight, I feel like I was a trainee manager who didn't really get any training, if I'm completely honest. So I think part of the problem with, and look, everything turned out okay, so it's fine. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and all those cliches. But I got appointed as the Channel Z program director after applying. I sort of got shoulder tapped to ask to apply for that. I think you show aptitude in your local market and you build reputation and you have integrity and you're the yes problem solver, all of that sort of stuff. And you get this opportunity, and I got that job, and that was incredibly exciting. But there was so much change for me. I mean, moving to Auckland, which is the home of the music industry, big network operation, part of a big, you know, More FM, Channel Z, two floors in Auckland, you know, you've got record companies schmoozing you, you've got all of this pressure, you've got big name talent that you're supposed to be managing. And I was like 28 years old, I think, and I didn't really get a little bit of mentoring, but not really a huge amount. And I didn't get any management training, and my whole life I've never been trained in management. I've never taken a management course. The only management training I've had has been self-taught, and I do a lot of geeky management reading and podcasts and stuff I have done over the last 20 years, because I kind of realized that nobody else was going to do it, and I wanted to be good at it. But I do feel conflicted about my Channel Z, my couple of years, sort of 18 months there, because I really struggled. I struggled with a lot of the elements. I really wanted to be there for the music. I probably would have been a better assistant PD than the actual PD, I think, in hindsight. And if I'd been the assistant PD for a couple of years, who knows what could have happened. But I think I just didn't handle the pressure that well, and I got to my second summer there and went, I'm just not enjoying this. I enjoyed my time in Wellington much more as ops manager. So look, I bailed out, and I would have loved to have done a good 3 or 4 years at Channel Z. And I've still got ongoing friendships with most of the crew there that I worked with. But I just felt like I was a bit underdone for that role. And that's okay. I can admit that now, you know, that was half a lifetime ago. But I will never regret being part of that station. I just, that's such a blessing. I mean, the amount of people that when you mention Channel Z, their eyes just sort of sparkle and they just go, oh my God, that was, oh my God, Channel Z was amazing. Why isn't it still around? It was the best station ever. You know, always having those conversations when you mention it. And it was just so, feel so fortunate to have had those years.
Because I think that's the thing that was a real shame about Channel Z, because obviously at one point it was rebranded. It kind of was at a point where I think the ratings were falling and things were kind of happening in management where it wasn't really going the direction that they wanted. And then eventually it was rebranded to Kiwi FM. Do you think that, like, going back, there is a place for maybe a station like that again? Because I know there has been rumors at different points in, I guess, the last couple of years where people have talked about bringing back Channel Z. Do you think there is a place for a station like that in New Zealand anymore? Because there is a demand for it, but do you think it would still work?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I won't be shy about saying it's definitely what we tried to do with Hauraki in 2014 was kind of do a Channel Z for Gen Xers who had got jobs and kids and, you know, a Channel Z / I like to call it festival radio, where, you know, you don't just go to a festival and stay at one stage and listen to rock music all day. You actually bounce around and you might have just as much time in the boiler room, talking big day out kind of style. I definitely thought of Channel Z and Hauraki as a big day out coming through your speakers, you know, where you'd get to sample a whole lot of different stuff. I think the problem with Hauraki is multiple problems with trying to turn that into that format, and one of which has just got such a strong brand as a classic rock station, and it's such a misunderstood brand that in hindsight, potentially it would have worked better if it had completely rebranded. But I think in today's, and then, you know, in the radio industry in New Zealand, so MediaWorks have launched Channel X, which is kind of obviously they're nodding to a Channel Z era, and there's some of the staple Channel Z playlist on there, but also it's a bit more poppy and it's definitely grounded in a more of a 90s 2000s vibe, but you can see what they've tried to do there. George, I mean, electronic music is huge, and George FM, I think, fills a place where, you know, you'll hear George FM as much as any other station on tradie work sites and stuff around New Zealand, around Aotearoa at the moment. Look, there's a student radio network, which is extremely niche, and you know, you have to be real lean and kind of open to new music and be challenged to sit there. And then you've got your commercial stations, of which probably Hauraki and George have got a little bit of overlap with where Channel Z might sit if it was still an entity, and a bit of Channel X, I suppose. I don't know if there's space anymore, just because the market's so tight and the advertising revenue is pretty tight. You know, it'd be interesting to see how Channel X goes revenue-wise over the next couple of years, and whether they move into a lesser retro format and start looking at potentially introducing some contemporary music into it to balance up. That could be an interesting shift that could happen. But as for launching a new product, I think most of the new products you'll find in radio in New Zealand tend to be targeted at 45 plus, shall we say. That's probably the reality, given the behavior of younger audiences and the fact that they're not being brought up with radio as a normal part of their routine.
Well, moving back to Hauraki, which we obviously touched on a little bit earlier on and you were speaking about right then. So that kind of brings up an interesting point, because I feel like you taking on Radio Hauraki's original audience was probably one of the bravest things to do in terms of rebranding. For anyone outside of New Zealand, Hauraki was, yeah, as David said, very much traditionally seen as a classic rock station. I could probably say that my dad had that in on the car all the time, as with my mum. It kind of reminds me of people wearing singlets, drinking Tui beer, and basically being on the work site. And then the thing that I felt was really brave, as you said, moving into something that was a bit more contemporary in 2013, it seems like you, like you said, taking the best things of student radio, the interesting music, or maybe the festival-style radio, but then also making it a little bit more alternative. How did you, one, handle the rebrand itself from an audience perspective? Because I can imagine a lot of people came back and hated on it. I definitely know absolutely despise it maybe even. But then you had this new audience that was growing through it. So when you went into the manager's office, said that you're going to rebrand the station that had a very, very strong audience. One, how did that meeting go down? Two, how did it feel on the first couple of days or weeks when you knew that there was going to be this massive backlash? And then how did you manage to kind of change that audience? Because now Hauraki is seen as like a very strong brand in terms of the radio scene. Walk me through that, because that must have been very stressful for you going through as program director with the responsibility of not only having to rebrand something that is like a staple of New Zealand radio, but then also try and maintain it with what was a younger audience and maybe a little bit more of a transient audience as well that could have moved any which way, maybe moved up to George somewhere else. So yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about that whole process.
Well, look, Jamie, it was absolutely a team effort. It wasn't all on me, which is good news for me. So the pressure wasn't all on me. So I credit my friend Mike McClung, who was a big part of me moving up. So I had been in Wellington and I was managing ops manager for all the music brands for Radio Network in Wellington. So that was ZM, Classic Hits, Hauraki, Coast, I think. And I was sort of across all of those four stations, and I managed the local Wellington Classic Hits breakfast show, and I coached a few other breakfast shows around the country. And then I kind of got shoulder tapped to say, would you be interested in moving to Auckland? My wife and I had just been up to Auckland to see Foles at Town Hall, amazing show. And nice that one. Was when we kind of had this, just had this phone call literally ringing in my ears, as in they had just had that. And then we had a weekend in Auckland and went, wow, we could do this. We could move back to Auckland. But it was Mike McClung had started that rebrand. So he'd started they had done the change of logo. He'd started moving the music format when he took over from Mike Regal, I think around 2012, 2013. So I used to work with Mike, full disclosure, at NZ On Air for a while. So I knew Mike pretty well and I've known him for many years. So kind of feel like we were a team doing that. So his job became overseeing the three key music brands for NZME, the networks, and my job was the program director solely for Hauraki. I knew for about 2 or 3 months previous that I was going to go into a couple of months previous, did a lot of listening to radio stations around the globe who were in a similar sort of formats. Went through a whole lot of old Channel Z stuff, started making lots of notes and lists and playlists and Spotify and all sorts of stuff to try and get into a sense of, and kind of had been to a lot of festivals and looking at, interested in what sort of music New Zealand live audiences were really responding to. So I think the change didn't feel, and I wasn't tied to Hauraki as a heritage brand because I hadn't lived in Auckland and listened to Radio Hauraki. Mm. So while I'd been listening to it as ops manager for the music brands, I'd listened to plenty of Hauraki, but you know, I associated it with the new Matt Heath drive show, and there were changes had already been made. So to me, it didn't feel like a massive leap. I think one thing that I do recall, I think it was about my third day in the office when we'd done a big music change. And I think Shapeshifter dropped at about 9:45 one morning. And I remember everybody in the office going,
whoa,
you know, like waiting for the flood of hate that was going to come pouring in from all those classic rock listeners, hearing some, you know, DMB on Radio Hauraki. But, you know, I mean, you look at Shapeshifter in New Zealand, they're one of the biggest bands in this country, you know.
It's a staple. Yeah.
It's a staple of summer soundtracks in New Zealand. So, again, my mindset was people are not, the kind of audience that we're looking at is not just, I listen to this genre of music and that's all. And having been to just about every single big day out in its existence in New Zealand, having been through the Channel Z experience, having been through multiple experience with NZ On Air and other radio brands and stuff, and listening to other stations that, yeah, they might play pop music, but a whole range of different vibes of pop. It didn't seem that strange to me that there would be an audience there for it. To be fair, I don't think we set the world alight with ratings, but what I think the change did do is it, we used to call it the Ponsonby 500, right? The influences and the inner city, the media people and media agencies and stuff, people started talking about it really quickly because we'd put Matt Heath and Jeremy Wells into Breakfast, and we launched that third week of January 2014. We put brought Mikey Havoc back onto the radio and put him in Drive. Mm-hmm. We had this music mix that people hadn't heard anywhere on the radio since arguably Channel Z days, so 10 years previous. And the talk amongst the 500, amongst the urban dwellers, spread pretty quick. And I think what probably saved us on that strategy was that we actually managed to do pretty well in terms of revenue, especially integrated promotions, because a lot of advertisers and media agencies wanted a part of it because it was cool.
I can definitely agree with that. I think it was definitely the trendy station when it came back, because Hodaki traditionally
was so weird, right? Because Hodaki was totally uncool.
Yeah, it was very hokey. It was the kind of thing that, like go into the local like pub and basically be on the background. And now it was trendy. It's kind of like now you imagine someone drinking a Recordling cider in Ponsonby and listening to it. You know, it can you manage to not only change the image itself of the station musically, but also the image of the audience who was going to be listening as well. It became a lot more cool. And the content itself, what you guys were talking about, was incredible. And the risks you were taking as well as even the hosts, like Mikey Havoc, having Mikey Havoc, Jeremy Wells, and Matt Heath, all who were, in lack of a better sense, absolute crazy bastards, like back of the
and
wise.
And Lee Hart, and Jason Boyd.
So you've got a bunch of mad Southerners as well. Yeah, you really were doing everything right in terms of just throwing it out there and seeing what happens, and it worked incredibly well. Because it all was very cohesive and it worked to the brand.
I think so. I mean, you know, I really enjoyed my relationship working with Mike McClungen, and it was definitely his baby. And I sort of felt like I was, entrusted with the car keys for a while and, you know, soaked up the pain of having to call Mikey at, 3:10 when he still hadn't arrived for his Drive show at 3:00 and figure out what his excuse might be that day. Because as if anybody knows and loves Mikey as much as I do, His punctuality is not his foremost talent, but he's an absolutely incredible broadcaster, an incredible person. But, you know, Mike McClung and I had a really tight relationship. We used to talk a lot. He had a lot of faith in the direction he had started, and he was really backed what we were doing. And, you know, I was just so fortunate to have such a great crew of people to work with. Jeremy, Matt, Lee, Mikey, some of my favorite talent that I've ever worked with. There were some ropey times where things got a bit chaotic but they're all grown-ups for the most part. And I think we all had a really good mutual respect for each other. And we had a hell of a lot of fun. We really did. The first few, I'm just thinking about the first few weeks of text messages, especially to the station, were there were a lot of unhappy classic rock fans. And look, I said before, Hodaki, it wasn't that it wasn't cool. It was just what it was. It was your dad's rock station, right? And it had its purpose, but all stations have to refresh their audience and grow at the younger end. Otherwise, they just naturally fizzle out and die.
And one point I want to go to as well is during this time, you were talking about how you never had a mentor, you never had anyone who was kind of pointing you in the right direction as a manager, but you yourself have obviously coached and mentored a lot of broadcasters that have come through New Zealand. How would you describe, one, your style of mentoring, and two, what influence do you think you've had on a lot of those people that you mentored properly throughout your career?
Ooh. Big question.
Because you being someone hasn't been mentored yourself, it must be interesting because you're purely pulling from your own experience rather than taking from other education that you've had. So yeah, I'd love to know how you feel your mentoring style works to the talent that you've had the pleasure of working with.
So I slightly amend. I think when I say I didn't have any mentoring, I had one mentor that, you know, that I will credit, which is Roger Clamp, who is still working for MediaWorks, and he was my boss at he was the overall boss of More FM, and he was ostensibly my boss when I was doing the Channel Z stuff as well. So Roger and I had I don't think I quite saw them as mentoring sessions at the time, and I don't think I ever probably got enough time with him over the years, but I would credit him with probably the one example of mentoring, or at least advice, that I did receive in those tender young trainee manager years. But I think the mentoring thing has probably come, and coaching thing has probably come about through talent, managing talent and getting talent to be able to perform daily and have confidence and be inspired and feel comfortable and happy, because most broadcasters come from a place of insecurity or anxiety or need to be noticed or a combination of multiple things like along those lines. And I think along with some of the management stuff that I was listening to and reading, I also read a few things about just about, I guess, self-help's the probably, you know, self-help's the broader title, but just really interested in constantly improving myself as a manager and as a person, which sounds super geeky, and I don't think I ever set out to be one of those guys, but it just kind of happened. But yeah, I think coaching talent, when I was doing that More FM, sorry, the Hits job, when I was coaching a few broadcasters around the country via Zoom, via remote, or Skype, or whatever it was back then, definitely tapped into some of that, just working on the person, not just the content, and felt that was a really natural place for me. I'm quite open. I'm quite a good listener, despite my verbal barrage today. And I'm genuinely interested in other people. I'm genuinely a curious person. I like learning. I like context. I like background. I like figuring out what makes people tick, not in a weird, creepy way, but just having an empathetic understanding of what's going on for them. And I think when you're dealing with breakfast shows in particular, breakfast hosts, they've got a weird ass routine, right? They have to go to bed at some stupid hour where you feel like you're missing out on half your life, because you've got to go start thinking about bed at 8:30 at night. They get up in the dark. They have to be on from pre-6 a.m, which nobody in their right mind wants to do. They have this incredible run of energy from 6 a.m, coffee, coffee, coffee. You know, then the listeners start interacting more and more after 7, and then they get on this massive buzz to about 9:30, pre-record the last couple of breaks. Oops, I gave away a secret. And then they come off air, and then they kind of have this weird space where they're kind of hyped, but they kind of know that they've got to go and sit in the office with their program director, who's going to just punish them with what they did wrong or what's coming up tomorrow. And then, you know, and then it's midday, everybody else is deep in their work, and they go off going, right, now I'm going to go to my second job, or now I'm going to go and mind my life for content for tomorrow, or, you know, whatever it might be. It's a very strange existence. And I think I got a real understanding of how that impacts different people by coaching a few different shows and a few different people who are at various stages of their broadcasting career. So a couple of them, one of the guys, Jordan, that I coached, he was in the first 6 to 12 months and a solo host in a small provincial station. And so he, you know, he and I had, yes, it was about content, but we also had a really lovely kind of life coaching, not life coaching, but life discussion relationship. And I think that's about building trust as too, right, Jamie? So you want these people to kind of not just do what you say and do the right things and get the promo scripts right and do all the stuff, but you also want them to have you need a trust relationship, I think, to have a good coaching relationship with an on-air talent. So that was probably one of my main drivers, I think.
So in a way, you not being a traditional manager actually played to your own hand, because it wasn't like you were trying to be the manager. You were taking it from like an empathetic standpoint rather than just, as you said, this is all content. We just need to have good content. It needs to sound good. You're taking it from the personality. And from that perspective as well, was there anyone that you worked with or mentored that you felt like at the beginning you weren't sure about what direction they were going or whether they had potential, but then after kind of digging a bit deeper, you realized there was something really there? Was there anyone throughout your career that really stuck out in that way?
Oh, I'd have to have a good think about that. I mean, I have worked a lot of people, which is, I'm really fortunate. I will go back to Jordan because, and Jordan left broadcasting not long after he still works in kind of in the educational side of broadcasting field, but he left radio after we'd finished working together. But he came from, being a pretty new provincial broadcaster, and then in his second year he won a radio award for best provincial breakfast show. And really reflected on it that much, but I think that's a really wonderful thing to feel, that you help somebody mentally and emotionally, and not just creatively, but all those other things. You help them perform at a level to which they could be recognized and appreciated. And that's, I feel really humbled about when I look back on that in retrospect, those sort of things. But, lots of broadcasters that I've worked with, from very experienced to very raw. I think I could tell pretty quickly those that were going to, I always looked for, sorry, I'll change halfway through my sentence. I always looked for people who had some kind of reel to them. I think those who were just performers and kind of put on a personality and put on a voice never resonated with me. And maybe that's big part of that's probably my student radio background, but also just me as a person. I just don't have much time for fake people or people trying too hard.
It's
the authenticity, and I know that's a buzzword now, but maybe coming through 90s commercial radio, it wasn't about authenticity. It was about a big voice and speed breaks and, keep it tight and bright and all that sort of stuff. But authenticity, I think, is probably what radio is for me, has always been radio's most endearing quality, right? That's probably what I really enjoyed when I was a young radio fan. And I just think it's a really important thing that they're real people and they're okay to be real people on air. And I think it worked.
I think the proof is in the pudding, because we were talking a little bit off recording before we even started this about the idea of, as you said, tight and bright was the previous kind of expectation for anyone in radio. Get to the ad break, get to the music, stop talking. Whereas now I'm even listening to stations that are having upwards of 5-minute voice breaks of just personality, people talking about a wealth of different things. And particularly, I know it's obviously very social media popular to talk about mental health, which is fantastic, but seeing all this content where people are being very open and vulnerable, do you think this is kind of indicative of kind of where radio is going, much like what we said off air, talking about everyone wants a Spotify playlist, it's easy to listen to, but people also want to hear a personality, so that's the key that radio has at the moment?
Well, we did talk about this previous to recording, and I had a further thought, is that, radio to me, I mean, there's the immediacy and there's the companionship and the portability and all of those things that it's always been. But I think in an era where we're well into a maturing streaming ecology where you've got everybody uses Spotify or Apple Music or whatever else they might use, we're well into a podcast ecology where there's billions of podcasts available for people to listen to, and people are being trained to listen to audio conversation that they're not actually physically a part of, but they can listen in their headphones or earbuds or whatever. So I think the beauty of radio is it's kind of a combination of both of those things, right? It's a playlist and it's got elements of podcast conversation. So music and conversation. And obviously both of those things are attractive to audio audiences. in terms of audio product. So it's kind of weird in that in some ways, both streaming and podcasting are proving something that radio knew all along, was that people enjoy those elements in terms of an audio digest or an audio banquet. And it's really pleasing for me to hear radio. I mean, obviously, daytime radio is still pretty tight in terms of breaks and stuff. But, you know, being able to hear hosts be genuine and have conversations and delve into things a bit more deeply, I think is much more rewarding and rich, enriching for the listener. And it makes me feel much happier about the future of radio anyway.
Well, there's a lot of things that you've made me happy for in terms of the future. I probably haven't told you this before, David, that I'm a musician myself. And in a way, you probably played a very big part of that. Obviously, love of not only music, but New Zealand music as well. Because you had very heavy involvement in what would become the eventual creation of New Zealand Music Month, obviously starting with New Zealand Music Week, which I know was established earlier on in the 90s. So I'll make the transition, obviously, to talking about David's career in New Zealand.
My other career. Yes.
Because you've jumped between the two. I think this is the thing I found interesting. It's like you did 5 years in commercial radio, then a bit in New Zealand on air, then back to commercial radio, then back to New Zealand on air. So we'll touch on, obviously, the transitioning back and forth, obviously, a little bit as well. But first of all, obviously, what inspired you to kind of move into, obviously, that area? Because commercial radio is very much its own beast. Why did you start working for New Zealand on air? What kind of brought you into that sort of realm?
There's a few factors there. I mean, yeah, the bounce, like, you know, these two careers, I think of it as like a tacking into the wind, right? So port tack is commercial radio and starboard tack is NZ on air, shall we say. So, yeah. I bounced between commercial radio and NZ on air, I think 3 times, flipped back and forth. I think NZ on air was something I was very much aware of through my broadcasting school days, especially. And I did the last few months of our broadcasting course was to basically do a thesis or a big research project. And the research project I had gave me the opportunity to fly up to Wellington and interview Brendan Smythe, who was the New Zealand music manager and my predecessor at NZ on Air, my lovely friend Brendan, and somebody who's very, very well known amongst music circles and broadcasting circles, now happily retired in Martinborough. So had a really lovely long interview with Brendan Smythe, and that was quite inspirational, I think, just, you know, having that moment. So that would have been 1997. I actually flatted with my friend of mine, Alex Bean. He and I were flatting together in Auckland, and he was the regional radio plugger for NZ on Air when I was at Channel Z. So we were quite the household, actually. We had me at Channel Z and him at NZ on Air, and lots of parties and different people, different folk turning up, and yeah, it was cool. But anyway, he got an opportunity in broadcasting, and I believe it was the Music TV, actually, show. And he was leaving NZ on air, and I'd left Channel Z because I was not feeling up to it, frankly, as we spoke about earlier. So I had a few weeks off, and then when he was leaving, I kind of went, maybe I could try that. And thinking, it's a bit weird going from this big program director role to being this regional radio plugger. What does that even mean? Turned out to be a genius move. And integrated with a lot of the music industry, got to work almost with the labels on promoting new New Zealand music, especially EMI, who did a massive amount of New Zealand music releases in those early 2000s. Got to take artists on road trips around the country to sing their new single and be interviewed on radio stations all around New Zealand, from Whangarei right down to Invercargill.
I got to go to
multiple music events. It really transitioned me out of radio into being better known or having better connections in the wider music industry. And I look back now, I go, that was absolutely vital for the rest of my career. And it's meant that the other thing that was great is it gave me a sense that, oh, there is life outside of radio, which I learned at a really young age. And as you know, a lot of people who kind of find themselves being booted out in their 40s or 50s go, what do I do? My whole life is this radio thing. And when you walk away from radio, you go, yeah, it's cool, but it's not the only industry in the world. You know, there's plenty of life and plenty of jobs and plenty of industries outside of radio. So I think that was really a great experience for me, that 2.5 years, working with Brendan, working with Camille Garswell, Nikki Donahue, some great, great people, and meeting loads of musicians and getting a real understanding, kind of going from the talent coaching thing, getting a real understanding of how musicians think and how what their reality is like, and having lots of conversations with artists and managers and video makers and producers and stuff like that.
You've probably had like some pretty decent front row seats to the rise of a lot of like pretty big New Zealand music legends, especially if you're coming from late 90s, early 2000s. Was there any particular standout moment for you that you feel was like a pinpoint on the New Zealand music scene? Obviously, that's not to say that New Zealand music itself now isn't at a level where it's still on the rise, but especially in the early 2000s, it felt like we were kind of like hitting out on the big hits of like the US and the UK more than any other time, like with like What Dawn Raid and a lot of the guys from like the hip hop kind of space. Was there any particular moment for you where you're like, man, the work that I'm doing with New Zealand on air is actually making a difference? What would you say would be that moment or that concert or that event?
You definitely do. You touched on the hip hop thing and the Dawn Raid. I mean, hip hop exploded. New Zealand hip hop exploded in the early 2000s. And I definitely remember moments like seeing Scribe and P Money do it, or actually mostly, I think it was just, Scribe and P Money doing a radio industry showcase before the Radio Awards one year, and Scribe sitting on a stool rapping to this three songs to this group of radio industry execs and thinking and blowing them away, and me thinking, yeah, this is a moment, and watching those first couple of Scribe singles just go supernova, right? That was incredible to be a part of. To see that Brooke Fraser coming through at that stage as well, I think, you know, I actually got a New Zealand Music Award for my work with NZ On Air promoting New Zealand music. So I guess we must have had our part to play in a few things. And I think we did have a lot of, we just were there to help. We were constantly there to help. And I think it was, you know, it's quite a unique thing. There's not many New Zealand On Air type institutions globally where the government invests in local content and invests resources to promote that local content and make sure that New Zealanders can see and hear themselves. So it was pretty unique. And Camille and I were and Nikki, we were quite the team. We were out at a lot of things, and we were a very big part of the industry and also the broadcasting scene as well. Not very big, but, you know, like we were definitely prevalent. So, yeah, it's hard to pin down particular instances, especially from that era, because that was like, oh my God, over two decades ago. Definitely that hip hop explosion was notable. And then there were lots of, I think because Channel Z was still around, there were lots of New Zealand acts that were debuting on Channel Z, but then they were progressing over to pop radio, like the likes of Zed. Even the Mid Chicks ended up on ZM for a while with Crazy Yes Dumb No. So those kind of moments you think, wow, that's cool. You kind of plug it at Channel Z, does well enough to transition over to, say, an Edge or something. And then, you know, Pluto's another band that's an example of that, where we got, you know, really good indie rock from New Zealand onto pop music playlists.
Do you feel like it was almost a battle of working against your own industry in a way? Because, funnily enough, I actually wrote a thesis at Broadcasting School about exactly that, New Zealand music. The rate of play, which I believe one of the main agreements that was made against commercial radio stations earlier on was 20% local New Zealand music, ideally, and most of the times those targets were reaching about 17-18%. Did you feel like it was almost like a battle against your own industry in a way to try and get that up? And secondly, obviously NZ On Air has had moments where people obviously are going to complain about anything, and people are going to say, why are you funding New Zealand music and other things like that? Do you feel like there was quite a lot of battles when you were working for New Zealand On Air, where not only were you trying to work against your own industry, but you also had people that were obviously very vocal critics against it? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I think, and I mean, probably fast forwarding a little bit to my time as head of music, because then you're front-facing most of the criticism. There's a couple of things, I guess, and, you know, having worked as 2IC to Brendan Smythe from 2008 to 2012, I learned a lot in that 4 years. And again, it was almost like that was kind of the trainee manager thing that I'd probably skipped on radio, was that I got to trainee manage as the head of music for 4 years, which wasn't really the job description when I first started that job, but it kind of, it got progressively more apparent that I was, Brendan and I were very tight, and I was definitely his support and assistant to his role. There's a lot of battles. You're a government operative, so you're a public servant. You're managing millions of dollars of taxpayer money. You are trying to set up frameworks that can best and most fairly and most transparently allocate a limited amount of funds to a limited amount of artists in a pool of artists that's almost unlimited, at a time where social media opinions exploded, and everybody, yeah. So you've got masters above, you've got masters all around and opinions all around. And I weirdly, for the most part, tried to block a lot of it out. And I think it's almost like that Hodaki thing as well. I think, I'm not, my own brain gives me enough grief in terms of self-doubt and overthinking. So I don't need to add everybody else's pile on top of that. I'm already analyzing and second guessing as it is. So I think I just managed in that role to try and almost keep those things at an arm's length. Obviously, listen, watch, read, learn, and respond, but try not to take too much of it super personally, because the position you sit in there, where you know all of the factors that surround it, whether it's the framework, the policy, your internal quote goals and quotas, strategy, all those sorts of things, those aren't things that you can express to the public or to necessarily, or drop into a bite-sized line in an email to a disgruntled artist. So you just kind of have to keep that stuff. You go, I know all of the stuff, but I just have to front it with, yep, try again, or yep, you don't agree, or yep, or just ignore. Probably now I look at that role and go, man, how did I do that? It seems just like an impossible task to, you can't please anybody. except those that you basically
fund. Yeah.
Disappointing everybody all the time. Cool. What a guy. But I was also very safe in the knowledge that it wasn't me sitting there handpicking what gets funded. And that's very important, is that, and the same with what Teresa does now, and the same with what Brendan did before me, is that it is, you set up the policies and the frameworks, and then you have other assessors and external assessors making those decisions. So, yeah, it would be a completely different funding portfolio if I'd just been picking my favorite songs, as you can imagine. But that would not be right. I don't know. I just think, I think it's a really interesting role. I'm glad I did it. I couldn't do what I do now if I hadn't. And it was probably a really makes sense as a kind of end point to my NZ On Air career. 3 tours of duty there over 20 odd years, but it was, I did that for 6 years. It's the longest I've ever been in any single role, because I'm not good at sticking around for a long time. I like change, which is why, Jamie, yeah. I like change. Yeah. And when things start getting kind of, you go and make changes, get things set up, and then it's change, and also new opportunities just kept popping up. And I got offered new opportunities on a regular basis, and that's quite, it's very humbling, but it was also very tempting multiple times to jump and do something new and fresh. So that's what I did quite often.
Yeah, totally understandable. And something else I kind of want to delve into in that same respect is, because a lot of people talk about New Zealand and air funding and how it obviously gets sent out, but one of the things maybe people don't often talk about, which I feel is particularly interesting now because of the fact that there's probably many artists that probably get funded by New Zealand On Air that may not get radio airplay in New Zealand, but are massively popular outside. For example, I remember reading an article that came out a while ago where you made a comment that people like Aldous Harding, maybe artists like Die, who are quite a well-established alternative band from Dunedin, get massive airplay, or actually Unknown Mortal Orchestra is probably the best example I can think of. Massive play outside of Europe, US. I'm based in Argentina. They have a huge following here. No one knows who they are in New Zealand. Do you feel like that's almost achieving your job in a way by giving out that funding that maybe some people would question but don't really realize how big of an impact you guys have probably had on some of these New Zealand bands actually breaking out of the radio sphere that maybe has restricted them beforehand?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's certainly not the purpose of the NZ On Air funding, but I think it's a happy byproduct. And I think that in a very small market, I mean, it's definitely an economic argument around, we come from a very small market. It's very hard to sustain a career out of domestic airplay, streaming and touring alone. In fact, arguably nigh on impossible in today's music economy to have a fully sustainable career. Very few who can make it just through New Zealand audiences. So I think overseas is essential. There's also that thing with us New Zealanders. It's, you know, we take notice of stuff once it's broken overseas, and, you know, the kind of reflected glory kind of stuff. But it's definitely not the core purpose. There was an international funding program for NZ On Air mid-2000s called Phase 5. And there was part of the promotions campaign to try and get New Zealand music heard overseas, and then it would reflect back and become more popular here. That got the kibosh, I think about 2010, 2011. So it was all about domestic. But I think music's a global platform now anyway, right? Like I said before, in the old 90s when I was in the UK, you'd buy music that wouldn't be coming out in New Zealand for 6 months. It doesn't happen anymore. You release on Spotify or global platforms almost simultaneously. Ubiquity of artists' releases across all the platforms, streaming and social, means that it's a global marketplace. So I think a lot more artists have got a global mindset now than perhaps used to have in the past.
And I want to move over to one other thing, because I think the whole idea of you moving between commercial radio, obviously the government funding and everything else, I guess the final question I'll touch on before we go into talking about Riddler Consulting, because I'd love to talk about your business that you have, is where do you see streaming radio and obviously New Zealand music in general going in the future? Like, do you feel like there is going to be much of a future for New Zealand artists to be able to still be on kind of New Zealand radio? Are we seeing like these sorts of percentages of New Zealand music being represented properly? Or do you think now it's going to be to the stage that if anyone's a New Zealand musician, they do need to make it outside of New Zealand, or it's probably better to target outside markets? I'd love to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, there's so many, as I sort of mentioned before, the economics of making music just in New Zealand, just for New Zealanders, just doesn't really work for many artists at all, or it's restrictive. And what I'm greatly concerned about at the moment is the mental well-being and the overall well-being of the music community. I think it's, I say this, and I'm putting this on the record now clearly, but I think it's one of the worst times economically to be, and also mental health wise, to be an artist in history at the moment, because the demands on your time and energy are so great, not just writing and recording music, which is a huge amount of time, effort and emotional vulnerability in there, but then having to constantly create content, constantly feed the machines, all of which, I will remind you, are global platforms, based overseas, who don't give a flying F word about New Zealand, let's be honest. So we're just all feeding these massive content kind of aggregators. And some of the offhand comments from the likes of Daniel Ek at Spotify, et cetera, about just, you know, I won't go into details, but, you know, it's just, I think there's so little regard from those entities about what it actually takes to be an artist in this era. And then the financial returns are so limited. This is a topic I've become really passionate about, sort of in the latter years of my NZ On Air time, and more so now that I'm independent, is just New Zealand artists coming to the realization that they really need to have, a bit like me, two sideline careers. And that is actually a positive and healthy thing. It's not a cop out or a giving up on your music career. You need an insurance policy. It's a bit like sports people as well, right? Sports people get to 30 and they go, oh, what do I do now? I've had it, you know, 18 to 30, I've just been doing sport. And now what? I want to be a commentator. But, you know, I think musicians need to go into their future eyes wide open about the realities, because I do not see the world retreating from a streaming ecology. How those payments work, I don't know, but we've trained audiences not to pay much for music. We've devalued music over the last 20 years so much, 25 years now, that if you tried to go, okay, well, you used to spend $100 a month on music, so that's what you're going to pay now for your streaming subscription, nobody would do it, would they? I mean, I used to spend way more than $100 a month on music. I don't now. Yeah, I might spend a bit more on live, but you know, to think we used to spend $30 on CDs and, you know, people will spend $80 on vinyl and stuff, but you try and put the subscription rates up on streaming services so that artists can eventually get paid some more depending on their various deals. It's just not feasible. So that I don't think streaming royalties are going to be the solution to those economic woes for artists. So I just think a big part of it is have two careers, and if you've got the right song or songs, I still believe something will cut through if all the stars align. But what's that thing about? What's the couple of things that stuck with me a couple of weeks ago? I read that thing about more songs were released. So this is in our current era. More songs were released yesterday than in the entire year 1989 in the entire world, right?
Which is mental when you think about it, putting it right. To perspective.
And then that,
bedroom
and then
producers.
That,
yeah.
Right? It's ridiculous.
It's insanity.
And then the other one, around 120,000 odd tracks daily uploaded across the platforms. It is ridiculous. Nobody can, and I think one of the audiences, especially older audiences' response to that is to just, you know, the safety and comfort of catalog, which is music that's older than 18 months old, that I already know that I don't have to spend heaps of time searching through to find something I like. That is the response of a lot of audience, I think.
We
all do. Of an age, we do naturally anyway, but it just becomes overwhelming. So look, I don't think anybody can predict the future of it all at the moment. We had an experience when I was at head of music at NZ On Air where we'd had a meeting with the guys from Pandora, because Pandora had an Australian office and they had an ANZ, Australian New Zealand footprint. And they'd come over and we were having a couple of beers with them and making plans for promo and all the rest of it. And then we got an email the following Tuesday saying, oh, we've just found out we're shutting down the Australian office and we all finish on Friday. So that was kind of a salient reminder that we are at the mercy of these global behemoths, and we cannot guarantee anything. Being a country of 5 million people on the outskirts of the world, about how they will regard this country, how they will regard our culture, how they will respect, you know, our voices and our music, or even us as a country. So, you know, I certainly hope that I think that's why the work of New Zealand On Air is just so important, because if it was all just left completely to market, I think everybody would just eventually disappear.
Yeah, and it's almost indicative of, as well, of kind of what's happening even at a local grassroots level, where I think you touched on a point that, like, the value of music has gone down so dramatically that I remember one of the last times I was back in New Zealand, which was around 2 years ago, Classic Kling went to my local music venue to go and watch a show. Cover charge was $5 on the door, and I heard someone complaining about paying $5 to go into what was a very cheap show. And yeah, I think it's reflective. I think streaming has ruined what was the value that was associated with music and art and culture, and taken it away for a $3 subscription a month. Well, I don't even know how much it is, to be honest. I'm probably paying the Argentine rates compared to the New Zealand rates. I'm sure it's $25 or something, probably regularly.
It's part of my, I think it's about 15 at the moment. I can't, I must check my Spark, maybe $16.99. I must check my Spark. I mean, yeah, the that same person complaining about the $5 door charge probably would have dropped $250 on a Coldplay ticket, right? So, I mean, that's 100%. the other crime of it all. And you know, there's a mentality around the cost of, I mean, it was Napster, right? Let's be honest. It was Napster that was the initial cause. So yep. It was basically technology. 100%. But then once the horse is bolted, you can't claw back. I mean, the industry did a good job to at least get some kind of payment for music access, which is the Spotify model, but the horse is bolted. And as I said before, you're never going to get people to pony up $100 a month. Which they used to spend on physical music product in the, say, 90s. Obviously, you've got some vinyl, some vinyl collectors who will easily spend that, probably a week. But for the general public, you're never going to get them much above, I think, their price point.
Yeah.
I think you'd be lucky to see it any much above $20 a month for most people.
Couldn't agree more. And we'll move into the final part, David, just talking about your business. As you said, you've kind of dipped out of radio. You saw that there needs to be other sides of life, and you moved into consulting, which seemed like a natural move, considering your coaching, mentoring, and everything else. So I'd love to hear a little bit, and this is kind of a plug for yourself. I'd love to hear, what is the business that you're working in terms of Riddler Consulting? What are the type of clients that you're working with, and what made you make the switch to obviously going full-time as a consultant?
I think deep down I had a lifelong fascination with people who owned their own businesses. I always thought that was real scary and pretty cool. And I don't think I'd ever really expressed that to myself out loud, but I think it was something deep inside me. I think NZ On Air, when I signed up for that job as head of music with Jane Wrightson, was the chief executive, and she asked me to sign a 5-year fixed term agreement because she'd clearly looked at my CV and knew that I like to move on reasonably frequently, which was great because it's a strategic role. And so I'm a big cricket fan. And I like a 5-day test match rather than a T20. I'm a long game kind of person. I like a strategic vision. So I really appreciated that. And, you know, one of my great, there were a few things that happened at that 6 years fight and ended up 6 years that I was really pleased about. But one of them was that we took the New Zealand music percentage on radio from around 12% up to about, I think it was 22-23% when I left, which, you know, the COVID era helped that, to be honest. But at the same time, we put a strategy in place, worked with the radio industry, just fine-tuned a few things, and obviously there was repertoire there as well, and obviously LAB and 660 didn't hurt, but you know, it was really pleasing to see that figure. You know, and that's a long game play. You can't do that in 5 minutes. So I've lost my train of thought, but yeah, I think going out on my own had been something that I had aspired to do at some point. I always thought radio consultants were really cool, the way they just swanned into a radio station for about 3 days and had all these really important meetings and had this flash laptop and briefcase and then swanned out again. It was pretty, realized my mixed results in terms of program directing and ratings and stuff meant that I'm not really qualified to be a radio consultant. But I guess I started doing when I knew my time was coming up at NZ On Air, I agreed to do one more year. And then kind of by about 6 months in, I was like, yeah, no, this is definitely the last year, so I'm going to start planning what's next. And that's when I came up with going out on my own. I thought, actually, you know what? I'm super lucky. I've formed a hefty list of contacts and friends in both the media industry, radio particularly, but also music industry. And when I say music industry, right through, like I say, from artists to labels to just, there's very few industry events I go to where I'm looking around for people that I know, you know, which I'm very, very fortunate. So I thought, well, it's a big relationship business. I've got a pretty good handle on some of the macro things that are going on, having been involved in lots of meetings with all the different organizations and stuff. and maybe there's something in this. And so it was definitely a leap of faith. I was turning 50. So it was possibly a midlife crisis element to that, Jamie, as well. But you know what I think most fundamentally important to me, and definitely in hindsight, is that we have later in life, so my wife and I had our daughter Poppy in 2018. And a big part of my role at NZ On Air was traveling away every fortnight, 2 or 3 days, sometimes longer. And work was forefront of my mind all the time. And it was, everything was shadowed by a work issue or work thinking or work problems. And I think this has become more apparent in the last 2.5 years since I've been doing this. The most important factor was that we have one daughter. She's going to be the one and only. I wanted to be mindful and present and of decent mood around her for some really important years of her life. So the upshot of what I do now is I get to walk her to school and pick her up from school every day. I get to hang out with her in the afternoons and watch as she smashes another couple of hours of Minecraft on the PlayStation. I get to read books to her. We watch movies together. We hang out in the park. So above all, you know, that probably limits my available time a little bit, but it's time that I get to do once. I got one shot at being a dad, and that is the most important thing to me. And I used to think my career was the most important thing in my life, and kind of still is, but she's more important than any of that. So that's pretty cheesy, but that's the upshot of what I've done. Yeah.
I don't think that's cheesy at all, because I think this is maybe another point that for anyone who isn't in broadcasting, maybe doesn't realize how over-encompassing working in this industry can be, because of the fact that it is so reliant on obviously being there at the right time, the right place, meeting the right people, networking, being on the ball, as you said, also saying yes to everything, being the person that will solve the problem. Maybe people don't realize how much of an effect that can have on your personal life. You even mentioned earlier in our conversation, 5 o'clock in the morning, you're having to get up, it's dark, you're not seeing anyone. It is an industry that can be quite hard on you. And do you think, looking back on it now, definitely, you're like, how did I do this? Like, I'm glad I'm at this point now.
I do. I mean, I definitely have a lot of energy. I can work long hours. I mean, I just did one of my most fun jobs recently was working as an artist in the artist liaison team at Northern Base, the festival up in Kaiwaka. And I'd never worked a festival before, and I worked for 5 days at Northern Base as artist liaison. So, you know, meeting DJs and artists as they arrive on site and taking them to the green room and blah, 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 and all that. Freaking loved it. But some days we worked from 10 a.m. till 2 a.m. And I'm just like chewing it up. Love it. Took me a week to recover after 5 days of that.
I can imagine.
But I definitely have an adrenaline thing. I get a lot of energy from being around people. I get a lot of energy from meeting new people and stuff. I've definitely learned that about myself. But I think also I just needed to keep some of that energy for me and my family. And that's been the happy byproduct of what I've done as an independent consultant. So contracting, consulting, I've done a lot of work for Recorded Music New Zealand in particular, who run the Aotearoa Music Awards. They run all the charts. They gather all of the mechanical royalties or the recording-based royalties for artists and right holders. And they engaged me straight off the bat when I left NZ On Air. They were going to do a review of the New Zealand Music Awards, and Joe Oliver, who's the CE there, who I work with very closely, sort of said, would you be interested? And my initial reaction was, hell no. I've just jumped out of a big role and I don't want to take on anything humongous straight off the bat. But of course I said yes, and that ended up being quite a defining piece of work for me, in that I one-on-one interviewed upwards of 100 different labels, artists, managers, producers, broadcast, you know, media, face-to-face. So my first interaction with them post-NZ On Air as a consultant, so that was a really good way for me to get myself out there with a different hat on, but also learned a huge amount, and it's involved me getting a lot more project work with Recorded Music ongoing, because that's sort of in a change, a really fun, interesting sort of 3-year change strategy, which is really spins my wheels, is that kind of change stuff. So that's been great. and working with, I do a bit of pro bono work. So I'm a trustee for the Auckland City of Music, which is a UNESCO designation. I've done a bit of ongoing stuff with BFM over the last year or so and the wider student radio network. Work-wise, I've done a couple of things back for NZ On Air. I've done a bit of change consulting for Te Mangai Pāho, for Radio New Zealand, a little bit of stuff for the Music Managers Forum and various other bits and pieces. And it's amazing because I just get to do different stuff all the time.
Mate, it sounds like you've managed to join everything that you love, which is changing roles as much as possible, getting to work with different people and networking at the same time. Yeah, it sounds like you've found the perfect balance of everything, including personal life as well. And David, how would people get in contact with you if they do want to work with you as a consultant? Obviously, you have a wide range of skills that you offer. So if people do want to get in contact with you and know more about what you do and maybe how they can work with you, how would they do so?
Thanks for asking. I didn't expect to be able to plug my little entity, but there you go. Look, I'm gonna make sure that I update my website with a few extra things, but it's riddlerconsulting.com, and Riddler is very importantly with one D, R-I-D-L-E-R. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram, davidriddler.nz. I'm on Facebook. I'm probably still on MySpace. But yeah. I think if you Google me, you'll find me. There's one other David Riddler in the world, I think, and he was a football player for a sort of a lower tier Premier League football team in England, because I did Google myself once, and that's what I found. But yeah, Riddler with one D, you'll find me. And yeah, look, I guess what I'm really interested in these days, first and foremost, is the coaching mentoring element of things. But, you know, I can do stakeholder reviews, I can do sort of change strategy, all that sort of stuff. But what I'm really moving into as my passion is just working with people and getting the best out of them.
Well, thank you so much, David, for joining me on the show. It's been insightful. I feel like I've learned a lot. Yeah, just thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me.
Jamie, I've never had a conversation like this before, so it's wonderful timing on your part to reach out, and I just wanted to thank you. It's an amazing opportunity. Appreciate it.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.